accession number 154503.
Commander Grenfell, Reel 3.
So I decided to take my ratings out into the forests. At least we had cover there, we wouldn't be seen. And there was nothing we could do anyway to help in the battle against these attacking aircraft, so we went out into the forest. And that was the best place to be, and then we'd come back to the camp. However, one day I saw that the forest was really a very pleasant place. So I... There were not many attacks on this particular day, so I went off into the forest with another of the naval ratings, and we were just walking. And suddenly, there was a ping of a bullet, and it went flying over our heads. And we looked around to see what it was, and we could see, only when we really carefully looked, we could see a figure of a Russian soldier, very brilliantly camouflaged, and he came towards us with his rifle, and he couldn't speak English, of course, and indicated that we should go with him. So we marched along with him, and we were taken to a clearing in the forest, and here it was one of these aircraft guns, several as a matter of fact, and there was a dugout there, like a 1914-18 war dugout, and he reported to someone, and some officers, Russian officers, came out of the dugout. Very fine-looking men. Don't forget, it was only not many years since the revolution, and a lot of those officers were still the sons of Russian aristocratic families. And so it was with one of them. He could speak perfect English, and he asked us what we were doing there, and we explained to them that we were survivors and so on, and we had just taken a walk because of the bombing down near the river. And then he became quite pleasant, and he invited us down into the dugout. That was an interesting experience. We went down, the two of us, and we sat there with several Russian officers and two or three Russian Red Army girls. And they had vodka there, and we drank vodka. And so one of the Russian Army girls said to us, "You are Angliski? Angliski?" And we said, "Yeah, Angliski, yeah." So she went to a pile of 78 records, and she got out a record. She said, "Angliski, Angliski," and she had a wound-up gramophone there, one of the old-type gramophones. She put on this record. It was "Donna Clara, oh Donna Clara," and this went on for a half an hour. As soon as it was finished one side, she would put it on again, and went on and on and on. She was so proud that she had an English record to play for us. Anyway, there was warning of another attack. We were taken out of the dugout. The officers shook our hands and told us we must never, never come into the forest again. It was a restricted area. And the soldier marched us back through the forest to a place where we were quite near our camp, and that was it. Then, one day, the aide to Admiral Bevan. Admiral Bevan was senior naval officer in Russia at the time, and his aide visited the camp. He didn't know that there were naval ratings there. He was just visiting the camp. So I went to him and I said, "By the way, you realize that there are naval people here?" He said, "No." He said, "We didn't know that." I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm one of them." He said, I'm the senior one, and we have another 10 or 11, I've forgotten what, because from my ship and from other ships. And I said, "We would like to go to a naval camp. We know that there are many, many naval survivors here from HMS Edinburgh," because the Edinburgh had been sunk, the convoy before our convoy. And he said, "Yes." He said, "They're all in a place called Vayanga." He said, "But," he said, "I can tell you, if you go there, you're very much nearer to the Finnish front," he said, "and there are attacks." And he said, "That's a Russian army camp, a real Russian army camp. A very large camp," he said, "and there's discipline, real discipline." He said, "Here you're more or less free." And I said, "No, we'd rather have the discipline." So we were transported by a tug down the river to Vayanga, and there started another period of life in Russia. Quite different this time, because there were British naval officers there, naval officers from the Edinburgh, whom I knew very well. And there were a large number of survivors from the Edinburgh who had been my shipmates during the time I had been in Edinburgh, so we were all together again. It was boring. There was no night. It was just 24 hours practically of daylight, and there was many, many raids, bombing raids. The Finnish front was not very far away, and there was an airfield not very far away, and it was called, the same word as the camp, the same name as the camp, Vianga Airport, and there were Royal Air Force planes there, and there were Royal Air Force planes flown by Russian pilots, quite apart from the Royal Air Force pilots, by Russian pilots, and they were practically every day in the air warding off attacks. And one attack, the I'm not sure whether she was a destroyer or whether she was a minesweeper, the Gossamer. The Gossamer was sunk in the river, not very far away from us, and that was a very bad business. She had not many survivors, and the survivors, those who did survive, were horribly wounded, and they were taken to hospital. In the camp with us were Edinburgh Naval survivors and survivors from other ships, and one of them was a 16-year-old boy from Glasgow. He was a boy seaman, and he had been sunk in one of the winter convoys, and had both of his arms and both of his legs had been amputated, and he had been brought from the Russian military hospital to this camp and just dumped with us, and we all slept in long beds, rather like these photographs you see of concentration camps in Germany, just long benches, and we lay side by side, and we did our best for this young lad, because there was nothing he could do for himself, but he was very cheerful. Never believe anyone who says it's better to die when you're in that condition, because he was very, very cheerful. At night time, we had no darkness, we could feel the rats jumping from one body to another, and I remember one night I was just slumbering, just nearly off to sleep, when I felt something wriggling down between me and the chap next to me. There were rats everywhere. And during the daytime, so long as there were no attacks, we had made a sedan chair for this boy, and that was an ordinary chair with two poles, and we strapped him on the chair, and we would carry him out through the fields into the forests and so on, to just for some relaxation, and he was extremely cheerful. What I heard later was that he did survive, was brought back in a convoy to England, did survive, and he lived. There were many interesting things there. The Russians were quite nice. They didn't have much to do with us, but they were quite nice. We had a guard either end of the hut. It was just a long hut. We had a guard at either end, just as if we were prisoners of war. But we were allowed to walk around, and once a week we were invited to the Russian Army Club. And this was a beautiful building. It was all made of wood, of course. Everything was made of timber. And there you saw some funny things. The Russians were had just come back from the Finnish front. They had 2 weeks at the front, as far as I can remember, 2 weeks at the front, and then they had 2 weeks break in this camp, and then they would march off to the front. And when they were there, they'd clean themselves up and get themselves into their best uniforms, and they'd go to this camp. It was always on a Thursday evening, I remember that clearly. And we would also go. We were in Russian uniform, by the way. I had a Russian uniform when I was there, because I'd lost all my clothes when the ship was sunk. We'd go along there, and I'd never seen this before. They were just so happy and so pleased. I mean, no doubt they had a dreadful time at the front. They were laughing and singing, no alcohol, and laughing and singing. And they had a wind-up gramophone at one end of this very large room, hall, and on the other end they had a three-piece band. You had luck if both the gramophone and the band were playing the same tempo. If not, you would find yourself dancing around to a waltz at one end, shall we say, from the gramophone, and having to change the step into a quick step when you got to the other end of the hall. It was not unusual, because there weren't many Red Army girls there, it was not unusual for Russian males to dance with males. That was quite accepted. And I had a friend from the Edinburgh. He was not from the Empire Lawrence. His name was Bailey, Ginger Bailey. He had a red beard, Barbarossa, the Russians used to call him, the same as the code name of the German attack on Russia, Barbarossa, and red beard. And it was very, very often the case where a Russian officer would come over, beautifully dressed with his jack boots, click his heels, and go off dancing with Ginger. Ginger would come back red in the face, so embarrassed with the whole thing. That was our relaxation. Food, we had our food in the main Red Army mess, along with the Red Army people, and we had the same food as they had, and it was dreadful. Three times a day, a sort of green soup, vegetable soup, sometimes you had a small piece of meat in it, and pine needle tea made of pine needles, was called, the Russian name for tea is chai. And it was good. It really tasted good. I've never tasted that ever since. Only the couple of months when I was in Vyanga, this Russian chai, pineapple tea. And that was it. This green soup and tiny piece, oh yes, and black bread, absolute black bread, chleba. And we had that three times a day. Discipline was harsh. The British naval discipline, we had our parades. They had to fall in and all the rest of it. There was only certain times for leave when we could go walking around, and even then we had to be careful because there were all sorts of Russian restrictions. And one day we met an engineer, a civilian, a Russian engineer. He could speak English. He was an educated man. So he was talking to us, and again this was Ginger Bailey, and he said to us, he said, would you like to come and have a vodka with us? He said, I live with a bargee from a canal somewhere, a bargee, there was this chap, this engineer, and a Russian sailor. So we agreed, and so we were invited round to this house, which wasn't very far away from the camp, and on the way, we had to pass a German prison of war camp. It wasn't a big one, but these were German prisoners taken from the front before they were transferred to another camp. And when I saw that, I only hoped I'd never be taken prisoner of war. They were just like animals. The ground was wet. Sometimes we had very heavy rain. The ground was wet. They were in rags and tatters. And as far as I could see, their food was thrown into it. It was a sort of a slop bucket, was thrown into a wooden trough. And they squatted around this trough and just grabbed the food out with their hands. And I must say that if they had been SS people, of course we knew nothing about concentration camps then, but if they'd been SS people, we would have probably said, well, they deserved it. But these were just ordinary German soldiers, and I think we felt sorry for them. So we went to this flat, and it was a wooden building, having wood, one stair up, first landing, knocked on the door. I wonder why he knocked, and then the door was opened by the bargee. Ah, come in, come in. Apparently they'd been told that we were coming. And we sat around the table, and the Russian sailor was in bed. And he had a blue and white striped shirt on. Hell of a nice fellow. And he sat up in bed, but I noticed he was covering something with the sheets or the blankets. So he didn't get up. He stayed in bed. So we started drinking toast. There was vodka there, to Churchill, to Stalin, and all the rest of it. And suddenly, the covers were slowly pulled back by the figure that was under the covers, and the most beautiful Red Army girl appeared. And all four of us sat. The Red Army girl, half naked, with the Russian sailor, Ginger, myself, and the other two, and we sat there drinking vodka. That was an interesting experience. The first time we'd really come up against Russians, except at the time when we were in this dugout in the other camp. Then we had to walk back to the camp, and that evening something really interesting happened. The Russians were strictly forbidden to get drunk during the war. It was considered unpatriotic. You should always be alert and on your mettle. And some of the people in our camp had made friends of a Russian petty officer, not army, petty officer. And as far as I can remember, He was from the airfield. He was the equivalent of our fleet air arm, and he had been drinking this on this particular night. So he came to our camp to speak to his Angliski friends, and the sentry outside our camp handled him very roughly, and he said, no, you want to speak to his Angliski friends. So we came to the door. It was quite late. It must have been about midnight, but of course it was light. It was not dark. And we saw everything that happened, and he saw one or two of the friends, and of course by this time the sentry had hold of him, and he waved to his friends and was talking to him and all the rest of it, and then the sentry had called another sentry and they marched him away. So we all went back to our bunks, this sort of board that was our beds, and about an hour later we had a volley of shots, and about an hour later still there appeared a Russian commissar to apologize for the behavior of his Russian compatriot. He had been executed. And that now appears in a book written about that camp. The story of the Vyanga camp appears in many, many books. We went to the cinema. They had a very fine cinema there, but they only had one film, and they played it every night. So if you were keen on the cinema and went every night, you saw the same film, and it was the Bolshyi Valtz. The Bolshyi Valtz was the Great Waltz, and they loved it. The Russians loved that one. Then came the day to go back. I suppose I was seven weeks there, something like that. And the master at arms from the Edinburgh, who had survived the Edinburgh, he was in the camp. He told us there was a convoy going back to Iceland and then to Scapa Flow. And then he read out a list. And I was to go in the Hussar. A very good friend of mine from the Edinburgh, Jimmy Farrell, was to go in the Niger. And we were good friends. So we went to the master and said, look, can't we go in the same ship? And I said, look, I'll go in the Niger, if you like, with Jimmy Farrell, and someone from the Niger can go in the Hussar. He said, no. He said, I've made up the list, and that is it. So he said, you, Grenfell, you go in the Hussar. Farrell, you go with the Niger. So we sailed. And there was very little trouble. That was the time when the PQ-17 would have been going up. So they're probably concentrating, getting ready for the PQ-17. We had very little trouble. Weather was bad. It was dreadful. And off the northeast coast of Iceland, one horrible night, I suppose the nearest thing I've ever come to hell, because we were all, due to our previous experiences when we were sunk, we were all very nervous, and we had no real bunks or anything, so we slept on the upper deck of the Hussar. And as far as I know, in the other ships, the survivors slept on the upper deck, huddled around the funnel for warmth, and with as many sort of blankets and things we could get, we were huddled around the upper deck. And it was dreadful. The weather, there was a blizzard, there was a gale blowing, mountainous seas, and everything was just black. And it was like just my idea of hell. And we were detached. One half of the convoy went in the direction of Scapa Flow, and the other half went in the direction of Iceland to Valfjord, I take it. And we could hear in the distance during the night six tremendous explosions. Woof. And we didn't know what it was. It could have been an air attack. It could have been anything. And then a couple of days later, when we were back in Scapa Flow, we heard that six ships had been sunk. And one of them had been sunk. No survivors. Was the Niger, with Jimmy Farrell. And this is the ship that I had said that I'd like to go back on, because I'd be with Jimmy. No survivors. There was a Russian ship sunk, an American ship, I believe, the Niger. There were six ships altogether sunk. And what had happened was a dreadful thing. Of course, the details came out years later, the end of the war, that the half of the convoy that had been detached and going in the direction of Iceland had made a navigational error and had run into one of our own minefields. It was not enemy action that sank the ships, it was our own mines. And then I came back to Scapa Flow. And now I'll say something which I suppose, really, I shouldn't, because I've never liked customs people very much anyway. But when we came ashore at Scapa Flow, we were in rags and tatters and Russian uniforms, carrying little sacks with a few belongings we had. Some of us had no belongings, I had nothing at all. But there was a customs officer and insisted on searching us all and making us open our sacks and so on, until a naval officer, a lieutenant commander, an old man, he must have been from the First World War, brought back from the war. He was on the shore staff at Lyness. Lyness was the name of the place we had landed at Scapa Flow. He came along and he argued like hell with a customs officer, and believe it or not, he didn't get anywhere, and he took him by the scruff of the neck and the seat of his pants, and he just marched him away, and he said to us, "Go through," and that was it. And then I spent some time on the Iron Duke. The Iron Duke. Was it the Iron Duke or the Queen Elizabeth? But I'm sure it was the Iron Duke in Scapa Flow. And then we were taken by train, first of all by ferry, from Scapa Flow to Thurza, and then we went on what was called the Jellicoe Express, a train from Jellicoe Express from Thurza down to London, and then from London to Portsmouth. And it took us 36 hours to get from Thurza to Portsmouth, because we were being stopped at various places, an hour stop here, 2 hour stop here, and then in Crewe there was a bombing raid, and we're stopping and starting all the time. And then we arrived at Waterloo, and a lot of people around Waterloo. It's a major station for troop movements, and we look like Germans, because the Russian uniform, most of us were in Russian uniform, with jack boots and this funny sort of cap and all the rest of it. I had a shapka, one of these Russian fur hats, and they thought that we were German prisoners of war. Some of them booed, some of them didn't. Some of them came over and said, and waved to us and so on, until they realized that we were British naval ratings. And then there was not so much interest. And we went by coach then to Portsmouth from Waterloo Station. I was then put on a petty officer's course. I passed a 6 months course. I passed that petty officer's course with flying colours, top of the course. I was always a studier. I used to study in the wet mess decks when I was at sea in the Edinburgh and so on. And then I was given the job as one of the few instructors in RDF in Portsmouth. And then later on, out of the blue, came the decision. That petty officer, I was a petty officer by then, petty officer William Edward Grenfell, had reached the necessary university standard to be an officer. Don't forget, right at the beginning of this interview, I mentioned you could only become an officer in the RDF branch if you had a university degree. I had to go to London, and I had an interview with Dr. Brunswick, and he was the head of the Royal Naval Scientific Service. And I had to sit examinations, and I passed. And then I was given an RMVR commission. I did a course, nearly 10 months course, sub-lieutenant, and I was top of the course of that one. And then I was appointed to the cruiser Leander to go out to the Far East.
Was this after the Far East War had finished?
Well, I'd come to that. To go out to the Far East. And I was in charge of the radar. By this time, I already sub-lieutenant RMVR. And just as we were due to go to the Far East, we were up in North Shields again, refitting, came the end of the war with Japan. So we didn't. We went instead to Portsmouth. We lay in Portsmouth for some time, and then they decided that some RMVR sub-lieutenants could transfer to the Royal Navy if they wished. And I considered this. I already mentioned that I had found the life that I really enjoyed when I, quite by accident, found myself in the Navy with its comradeship and its discipline, and I decided to stay in the Navy.
That, I think, was 1946.
That was 1946. And they gave me a commission as lieutenant, gave me an extra rank, backdated to 1944. So really, I was a lieutenant on paper before the war ended, backdated to 1944. And we went out to the Mediterranean. I was in charge of the radar, of course. By that time, we didn't only have the long-range radar. We had a short-wave centimeter radar against surface ships, fire control for controlling the guns, and I was in charge of all of this. And we did mostly runs from Malta to the east. It was a time when the ships were trying to carry Jewish refugees to Israel, and it was our job to stop them. And nothing against the Jews getting there, but too many of them were arriving at one time. So we were engaged on that for a while, and then we went to one of the most tragic things that has happened since the war. We were sent to Corfu, and there was a great argument going on between the Albanians and ourselves about the use of the North Channel. And the admiral commanding the Mediterranean Fleet, or at least this part of the Mediterranean Fleet, was Admiral Kinahan. And I was in the Leander. There was the cruiser Birmingham, I think, the Manchester. And there were several destroyers. And two of these destroyers were the Saumarez and the Volage. And it was really an operation designed to show our defiance of the Albanian decision that we would not be allowed to sail through the channel. I'm quite sure, this is my own personal opinion, that the decision was not made by a naval officer, because it was so foolhardy. I'm sure it was made by the government, perhaps the Foreign Office. So we sailed through, and my heart was in my mouth, I can tell you. This narrow channel, knowing it was mine, and went through line ahead, just as if we were on a fleet review. And I was on the bridge of the Leander, just beside the 293 office. 293 was a type of radar. I was on the bridge, and right ahead of us were the destroyers, Saumarez, and Volage. And suddenly from the Saumarez there came a huge explosion, smoke, all the rest of it, and she started to settle in the water. We realized, of course, she'd hit a mine. So we changed course a little, and we sailed by, the whole fleet sailed by the Saumarez, wondering whether we wouldn't hit the mines ourselves. And the Saumarez was left there. And then the Volage was detached to sail back to assist the Saumarez. The Volage bows first, of course, went towards the Saumarez to take off the people, because it was quite obvious the ship was absolutely wrecked, would probably sink.